Welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. We have a packed show. Coming up in just a bit, spring brings a full calendar of hands-on discovery at North Dakota's Gateway to Science in Bismarck. Education Director Alicia Kellum is our guest, and she'll preview what's ahead. And it's Tech with Peck. We mark the 50th anniversary of the personal computer. Both George and I tell the stories of our first computers. Pretty sure you've never heard of them. And news director Dave Thompson joins us for our weekly review of the news. But we begin Main Street today with our weekly A Closer Look with the Monitor. This is Main Street, and this is our newest edition of A Closer Look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and this is our weekly discussion and conversation with reporters from the North Dakota Monitor. In this edition of A Closer Look with the Monitor, we're examining two developments that could have significant implications for North Dakota's economy and financial future. First, a recent ruling from the North Dakota Supreme Court that could reshape how oil royalties are calculated and paid. The decision centers on the complex financial relationship between mineral owners and oil companies, an issue that affects thousands of North Dakotans who receive checks from wells across the Bakken. Legal experts say the ruling could trigger a wave of new litigation and potentially change how companies account for transportation and processing costs when distributing royalty payments. Then, we'll turn to a very different but equally ambitious proposal from the Bank of North Dakota, the creation of a state-backed digital currency known as the Rough Rider coin. Supporters say it could position North Dakota at the forefront of financial innovation, while critics warn that digital currencies come with regulatory and financial risks. To help us understand both of these very complex stories, it's my pleasure to be joined by North Dakota Monitor reporter Jacob Orlidge, who's been following these developments very closely. Jacob, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Hey, Craig. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with the Supreme Court decision. What exactly did the court rule, and we're talking about the oil royalties, what exactly did the court rule, and why is it generating so much attention in the oil industry?
Well, the North Dakota Supreme Court essentially voided or reversed an order from the North Dakota Industrial Commission. And the Industrial Commission, composed of the governor, the agriculture commissioner, and the attorney general, has among its duties the job of regulating oil and gas in the state. The order that was voided by the Supreme Court essentially attempted to state unequivocally that an oil company that had approached the Industrial Commission asking if it was performing its royalty calculation correctly, the order from the Industrial Commission said, yes, this company, Petro Hunt, was doing things correctly. And the Supreme Court, when it voided this order, did not necessarily do so on the merits. So the jury is still out on this particular issue. It voided the order on procedural grounds.
For listeners, Jacob, who may not be familiar with how royalties work, give us that 30,000-foot overview of the basic arrangement. When an oil well is drilled on private land, how are mineral owners typically paid?
Okay, so thousands of people, both in North Dakota and in other states, own the oil and gas underground. These are typically called mineral rights. Sometimes it's the same person as the surface owner, sometimes it's not. But when an oil and gas company wants to develop that resource underground, they will typically approach the mineral owner and ask them to sign a lease. The oil and gas company will receive permission to drill for and produce the oil and gas that's under those mineral rights. The mineral owner will receive a cut of the revenue that's received from that production. That cut of the revenue, called a royalty, can be anywhere from 12.5% in older leases all the way up to 20%-ish in some newer leases. It depends on where you're signing it and the company and all of those negotiations. But the second half of that, as it relates to this Supreme Court opinion, is something called overlapping spacing units. And I'll just take a quick stab at trying to explain this, Craig, because it's really complicated. Some of the smartest people I know in the industry and the legal world have told me that this is insanely complicated. But every well or every group of wells is drilled as part of a spacing unit. These spacing units are typically 1 mile wide, 2 miles long, and that sort of delineates the area in which the oil is coming from for any group of wells. It also delineates who is receiving royalties, who is receiving a share of that production from those wells. So any royalty owner in that 1 mile by 2 mile rectangle on a map would receive royalties from that group of wells. Where it gets complicated is when you have multiple units like that on a map side by side, because there are regulations in place to stop you from, or stop a company from drilling too close to the edge so that you don't accidentally drain the oil that's actually owned by your neighbor. So what the Industrial Commission does is they give companies permission to drill section line wells. These are wells exactly on the border between two neighboring spacing units, the border between two different groups of wells. For these section line wells, the Industrial Commission creates a new shape on a map called an overlapping spacing unit. And this overlapping spacing unit essentially says administratively, this is the geographic area that is affected by this new well that's on the border, the section line well. These overlapping spacing units sometimes partially cover other spacing units, and sometimes they fully cover other spacing units. What the Industrial Commission and the majority of oil and gas companies in North Dakota have been doing is they have been paying royalties from these section line wells, the new wells on the border, to royalty owners or mineral owners in the original spacing units, even if they are not located within the overlapping spacing unit, because they say that these mineral owners are also affected by this new well because of essentially principles of geology and how it affects well production underground. But this takes away from the royalties that are being paid to mineral owners in the overlapping spacing unit, the new spacing unit that was created specifically for this section line well. And that's sort of the issue. That's the divide. Who should receive royalties from the section line well that the Supreme Court was asked to handle? They did not rule on the merits. Essentially, they punted the issue back to the Industrial Commission saying, you have the power to make these decisions. You went about it in the wrong administrative fashion. So we're voiding your order. Go back and do it over again.
Jacob, we were discussing off mic that this is in many ways pitted mineral rights owners, neighbors against neighbors. And you said earlier, this impacts thousands maybe of North Dakotans. How important are these checks for those families and for the local economies?
It can be incredibly important. Mineral owners come in all shapes and sizes. So you've got the large mineral owners who may own thousands of mineral acres in prime territory, and they may receive hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars. And then you've got the other end of the spectrum. You can essentially think of them as mom and pop mineral owners. You have a couple dozen mineral acres from that you inherited from your father or your grandfather or your great-grandparents who might have homesteaded in the area, and they might receive a couple hundred dollars a month from these in royalties. And that supplements their income. That helps them raise a family. That helps them supplement their retirement. And in those cases, it can be incredibly important whenever there's a hit to this royalty income.
This also has, in one way, pitted oil companies against oil companies. Jacob, give us more on how that friction has evolved here, about how royalties have traditionally been calculated.
Yes. So this issue, the overlapping spacing units, it's created a divide, not only between mineral owner and mineral owner, but between oil company and oil company. The North Dakota Industrial Commission has in the past estimated 85% of the oil and gas operators in North Dakota follow their method. The other 15% have decided to keep the royalties within the boundaries of the overlapping spacing units, even if mineral owners outside of it may or may not be affected by the new well. These These companies are a minority in North Dakota's oil and gas landscape, but they do include some significant players in the oil field, including Continental Resources.
To use a quote from your reporting, the phrase, a hell of a lot of royalties, appears in your coverage. Why are the financial stakes potentially so large?
The financial stakes of this issue are potentially very large because because of the sheer volume of people it could affect. A regulator with the North Dakota Industrial Commission in 2024 had said there were 1,400 section line wells in North Dakota, and there had been permits awarded for 2,000. That regulator projected they would reach 3,000 permits soon. That was almost 2 years ago now. And I've asked for more recent numbers. The Department of Mineral Resources says they do not currently track those numbers. But for each of those section line wells, there could be dozens, there could be hundreds of mineral owners affected.
Jacob, looking forward here, why do some legal experts believe that this will trigger litigation?
So attorneys involved in this case that I've spoken to believe that there could potentially be a new wave of litigation on this issue, no matter what the final outcome is. Because the fact of the matter is, you've got one set of companies doing it one way, another set of companies doing it another way. And whoever eventually ends up on top, that this is the way to do it, somebody has been doing it wrong. And that means that the oil companies have been either not paying people that they were supposed to, or paying people that they were not supposed to, and underpaying others that they were supposed to be paying more. And the scope of that and how many people could be affected by that, it is really hard to estimate. But attorneys involved in the case certainly believe that one way or another, there are going to be a large number of people who are going to be engaging in litigation, either asking for royalties that they believe they should have been paid, or defending themselves when oil companies come and say, we mistakenly paid you this money. Can we please have it back so we can pay the rightful owners of this money? And there are going to be a lot of disputes, and no one is sure what form that litigation is take, let alone how it's going to play out.
Safe to say that this will be disputed for maybe months or years to come, and you'll be following it as it goes forward, Jacob. I want to turn now to a completely different story that you've been covering. I'm enjoying my conversation with Jacob Orledge. He's a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor, and we visit weekly in a segment we call A Closer Look with the Monitor. You can always read Jacob's reporting and all of his colleagues' reporting at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. Excellent coverage from issues around the state, free from paywalls or subscriptions. Jacob, now we're going to talk about the proposed Rough Rider coin from the Bank of North Dakota. First of all, it's a stable coin. A lot of people are listening or asking now, what's that?
Well, a stable coin is essentially a form of digital currency. Now, when we think of digital currency, we typically think of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, and all the other crypto names. That is not what this is. Not necessarily. It's a stable coin is a digital currency that has been tied to the value of a traditional currency, almost always the U.S. dollar.
In this case, it is the U.S. dollar, backed by blockchain, but go ahead and go forward.
Yes. Thank you for that clarification, Craig. The North Dakota, the Rough Rider coin that the Bank of North Dakota is developing will be tied to the U.S. dollar. And federal regulations that were put in place, last year, require $1 to be held in reserve by whatever financial institution is holding a stablecoin to ensure 100% that the stablecoin can always be liquidated and redeemed for that dollar, the value to which it's tied.
Certainly less volatility then in this Rough Rider coin market versus traditional Bitcoin.
Yes.
Jacob, many listeners, I think, are wondering how this might be used in the state of North Dakota. It's my understanding this is more of a bank-to-bank product rather than a consumer product like other states, like my native state of Wyoming has turned to in its frontier coin, I believe it's called, where consumers may use this coin for transactions and commerce. The Rough Rider coin, at least initially, is it a bank-to-bank tool?
Yes, there are a variety of uses that the Rough Rider coin could eventually be put to. The Bank of North Dakota executives that I've spoken to since the announcement in October of last year have emphasized that the Rough Rider coin, it is solely going to be essentially a background tool. It's going to be used to streamline bank-to-bank transactions, to enable financial transactions, especially international financial transactions, to happen in minutes, whereas using traditional methods, it might take days for the money to officially move through the financial system. So it's a way to make the back end of the financial system move more efficiently from how it has been explained to me. Now, down the road, could it be used in a way similar to, I believe it's called the Frontier coin in Wyoming?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. Down the road, could the Rough Rider coin act in a similar manner where you walk into a store and you pay with a Rough Rider coin that's in your digital wallet? Maybe. It's could certainly be on the table, but that is not what the Bank of North Dakota is focusing on right now.
In your reporting, Jacob, you say that some bankers were cautiously optimistic, but also raised concerns. What are the biggest risks that are currently worried about in the state?
So I'll preface this by saying we should know more about what risks the Bank of North Dakota is looking at later this month. The Bank of North Dakota will be presenting a what they call a business case, but essentially a risk assessment and a detailed plan to the Industrial Commission later this month at their meeting. And the Industrial Commission will have to sign off and give the green light before the Bank of North Dakota moves forward with the Rough Rider coin. In my reporting, I've heard from bankers in North Dakota, and the primary concern so far appears to be regarding liquidity. Now, I am not a banker. I'm not a financial analyst. I strongly encourage you, if you have concerns, to talk with your local bank and see if they're going to be involved or anything like that. But essentially, the concern is that because the Rough Rider coin will be tied to the value of the US dollar, and federal regulations require a US dollar or an equivalent instrument like a US Treasury bond to be held in reserve for each stable coin. The concern is that that is going to be taking deposits off of banks' balance sheets. And that's potentially problematic because that will take money out of the pool that's available for lending within local communities. We have not seen how this is going to play out yet. Those are concerns that are out there. And the Bank of North Dakota is putting together a risk assessment. From what I've been told, they do not see that as a significant concern when it comes to bank-to-bank transactions, because these stable coins can be created or dissolved on demand. But it is a concern worth watching.
What's a timeline, Jacob, that you understand relative to how the Rough Rider coin may move forward?
So as of right now, the next step will be later this month at the next Industrial Commission meeting. The Bank of North Dakota will come to the Industrial Commission and they will present its business use case. This will include a detailed plan for how the Rough Rider coin will be used. It will include a risk assessment and proposed safeguards to protect North Dakotans and the North Dakota banking system. And it will also include cost projections on how much all of this is going to cost the bank and the state. After that, if the Industrial Commission gives the green light to the Rough Rider coin this month, the bank says they are on track to begin a pilot project with a handful of financial institutions in North Dakota in September. After that, no timeline has been released. So the bank will probably take a look at that pilot project, see how it goes, and move from there.
As we kind of wrap it up, what does this proposal say, Jacob, about how North Dakota is positioning itself in the future of digital finance?
Bank of North Dakota executives have said that this is the first example of them, quote unquote, picking their spot in the world of financial technology. They want to ensure that North Dakota banking institutions, whether you're a small bank or whether you're a small bank in a small town or you have locations across the state, the Bank of North Dakota wants to make sure all of those financial institutions have the tools to survive in a digital world. And that means taking seriously everything coming out of the fintech, the financial technology space. This is the first example of them trying to do so, and they want to make sure that those tools are available.
That's North Dakota Monitor reporter Jacob Orlich discussing two developments that could have wide-ranging implications for the state, from how oil royalties are calculated in the Bakken to the possibility of a state-backed digital currency known as the Rough Rider coin. You can read Jacob's full reporting on these stories at the North Dakota Monitor website, northdakotamonitor.com. It's a website that is free from subscriptions or paywalls. The reporting is excellent. Jacob, thank you so much for joining us on A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thank you for having me on.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents Masterworks 4, The Seasons of Vivaldi and Piazzolla, March 14th and 15th. This all-strings program features concertmaster Sonia Bosca-Harrison in Vivaldi's Four Seasons and Piazzolla's Four Seasons of Buenos Aires. Details at fmsymphony.org.
Still to come on Main Street, Tech with Peck. We look back at the personal computer as Apple turns 50 this year. And Alicia Kellum from the North Dakota Gateway to Science previews upcoming STEM programs for kids, families, and even adults. Plus, Dave Thompson and I review the news. That's still ahead on Main Street. Stay with us. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and for younger listeners, it may be hard to imagine a time when computers
stop
everywhere. Hey, I can barely remember. They weren't on our desks. They certainly weren't in our pockets, and they weren't in our cars or our homes. But all right, the modern personal computer revolution really began about 50 years ago. George and I remember. And it began when two young entrepreneurs, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, built a computer in a California garage and launched what would become Apple Inc. Since then, personal computing has evolved from hobbyist kits, remember those, George, from Radio Shack and blinking command lines to powerful machines capable, of course, of running AI, editing films, editing this audio, and doing a lot of other things. And to talk about this fascinating history of the personal computer.
Is this old guy?
Right there with you, buddy. And we're going to talk about where technology may go. We're with our friend, our contributor, George Peck, for another edition of Tech with Peck. Welcome back, George.
Thank you. Well, what?
You will never guess what my first PC was, so I'm going to ask you what yours was first.
All right. Well, so first of all, it wasn't a Wozniak Jobs, and we would need to go back and do a little verification, because I think they were like Heathkits and things even before that. But my first was the Radio Shack TRS-80 Model 1.
Is that the one with the 6-line display?
Yeah, I think it had it was like 40 characters wide. I think it was like 24 lines. I can't remember that exactly, but I remember it was, it was 1-4K monitor. I know that.
No. All right. Here was mine, George. This is gonna make you laugh. Made by Coleco Toy Company. It's called the Atom.
Okay. I think I kind of remember that. Yeah.
About $750. I bought it when I was a junior at the University of Wyoming, and it came with a daisy wheel printer. You could program the thing and at a very rudimentary, but better than nothing, word processor. And it lasted for about 6 months.
All right. How did you save a file?
So we saved, it had two, one was the operating system, the other was storage, cassette-like devices. They were tape. And they looked like a cassette. They weren't exactly cassettes. I don't remember exactly what the technology was, but it was essentially that. And you bumped the thing and you started over.
Yeah.
It was way, way back in the day. But, those were what we had to grow up with. And I remember, George, that my first IBM PC, which I think was the first serious computer that I used, was maybe a year and a half later. I wrote my senior project on it in a programming language called Turbo Pascal. But that was at the University of Wyoming. There were two in the CNI, the Commerce and Industry College. And that was it back then. And then off we go. So how did you use your first computers, George? Do you remember?
Well, so I actually have a picture somewhere of my cousins looking at this TRS-80 Model 1. And it was just pure fun. And it was basic coding. And I found a Mad Lib program. And Mad Lib was where you input 5 adjectives and 5 adverbs and 5 nouns. And it would generate this story at random and just fill in the nouns, the verbs, and the adverbs. And it was really funny. And that's the one program I remember that got a lot of mileage out of that TRS-80 Model 1. By the way, I would load that program off a little portable cassette player with
a legit
little headphone,
player.
A little headphone jack that just used a real cassette, and you would press play and then load the program and then press record and save the program. But that was the particular program I remember was the Mad Lib in
all right.
TRS Basic.
Yeah. And then, of course, they evolved. Floppy disks came along. I was trying to remember when we got the 1.2 megabyte floppy drives, we all thought we were in heaven because we would never need more than that. And then they became 10 megabyte hard drives, and we were all in heaven again because we would never need more storage than that. At least that's what I was thinking. And boy, that wouldn't hold anything. Wouldn't even hold this what we're talking about today as we record it digitally.
I mean, there's so many, memories here. So the IBM PC was announced. I lived in Billings, Montana at the time. The nearest computer land which sold them was in Spokane. And I flew to Spokane to look at it, ordered it. It took 4 months to ship it to Billings, Montana. And that was the very first one potentially in that city in 1984. It had 2 160K diskette drives. That was the original storage for those. The thing I remember was my first hard disk was a 5 megabyte.
Okay.
We talked home theater for a while, and I will rip a Blu-ray or a 4K Blu-ray, and I watch the progress of the rip. That 5 megabyte hard drive would be filled up in the first about 750 milliseconds of ripping a 4K movie.
Milliseconds.
In less than a second, 5 megabytes long gone. It's just amazing how the technology has changed. And Craig, I'm looking across my basement. I have a Synology Network Access Storage, a NAS. 8 slots, 14 terabyte drives each. Do the math.
There's a lot of zeros added on to that 100 and some K disk that you had. George, I spent a lot of the first part of my professional career utilizing DOS and a little bit later DR-DOS, which was a clone of the disk operating system that IBM made popular prior to them releasing OS2. That was a big deal for many businesses at the time, and it did a lot of things early on. Is that your recollection too?
Yeah, so DOS 1.0 was the first one I had, and it was IBM DOS. They had actually bought it from a little tiny brand new company called Microsoft that actually wrote IBM DOS 1. MS-DOS then became its own operating system for clones, if we remember an IBM clone.
Yeah.
But it was DOS 1.0, 2.0, 3.0. They were all command line operating systems. There was no graphical user interface.
Yeah, none at all. Mouse
and
wasn't
I remember. I remember DIR. I remember MD, CD. I mean, directories were only later in like DOS 2.0 or 3.0. So before that, there weren't directories. So MD, CD.
File names had limitations. Copy,
8.3.
Copy and okay. X-copy was a big deal when it evolved. And then we came to this thing called Windows. And I would love, George, to be able to show somebody the first iterations of Windows compared to what we have today.
It was Windows 1.0, and the only Windows version that was even probably usable, I think, was Windows 3.1. We can remember and laugh at Windows 95 and really laugh at Windows 7. But yeah, all the progressions of Windows, and I had every one of them. So it's been a very interesting transition through the graphical user interfaces. Yes.
I'm curious, George, do you remember the first time you used the internet? I do.
The thing I remember well before that was bulletin board systems and CompuServe. Yeah. So I actually, to tell an interesting
story.
There
was RBVS before that, right?
Well, I wrote the first bulletin board system for the IBM PC in BASIC. I don't know, it was like 1986 or 87. This is a fascinating thing, Craig. I found some time ago a list of customers I'd sold it to for like $74.
Nice.
One of the customers who bought my bulletin board system was a guy named Michael Dell.
Oh, my goodness.
In Austin, Texas.
Yeah,
he paid me $75 for my bulletin board system in the mid-80s. So that was how I would log in. And then CompuServe was the first online dial-up modem. My first internet experience was probably through Earthlink, a dial-up to Earthlink and their browser and the internet that way. So that's been a while.
I had worked for the Department of Health in Lander for the state of Wyoming, and I remember using Netscape or a similar piece of software, and I think they were called Netscape still at the time, and looking at the first iterations of somebody's web page and just recognizing that my world was going to be different from now on. So, all right. So in many ways, the thing that's most surprising where we're going to get to today, George, is you and I have both have owned many computers along the way. Laptops, probably tablets. We have phones now that are many times more powerful than those first computers that we bought. So what are you using right now, George? What do you use for your computers at home?
I have, I'm looking around the room. So there's an Apple M4 company machine in front of me folded up, a MacBook Air M2 to my left. Over under a bench, I have a Dell server that I finally retired and turned off. Above that, I have the Mac Studio out of my recording studio that's down here now because my recording studio is in pieces. Behind it is perhaps the most interesting. It's a Miniforum MSA2, if I got my models right.
What operating system?
So it's running something called Proxmox, and Proxmox is a Linux-based operating system that's designed primarily for data center, multiple computer, virtual computing. And so on the Proxmox, I am running two VMs. I'm running a Linux VM, a Linux Ubuntu VM that I'm running my website on.
VM stands for a virtual machine.
Virtual machine. And then I'm running a Windows Server 2022 virtual machine. And this, the Miniforum is about the size of a textbook. And I've got, I think, 84 gigs of RAM in it and 2 terabytes of solid state drive. And it is, and it cost about $1,200.
Yeah.
And I could add probably another 5 VMs on it and it wouldn't even break a sweat. So the technology has changed a whole lot.
What do you think's next, George? What do you think your next computer purchase will be? Because I'm at the point now where I'm not sure I'm going to buy a new one. Everything that I need to do and that I project wanting to do, I think that I can do with the system that I have.
Yeah, well, so do I, but I don't care.
That has never stopped you. Yes.
It doesn't ever stop me. The next one will probably be a new MacBook Pro. I just have to have, and I have converted. I was a strict, I worked at a computer land, Craig, and I remember someone coming in and saying, and I'm not kidding you, they wanted to buy a Commodore 64. And this was a computer land that was selling IBM PCs.
Very popular computer, by the way.
Right, right. And we didn't sell the Commodore 64. And he said, well, where can I get a Commodore 64? And I said, try Toys R Us. And he got really angry at me and ran out the door. So at that time, I didn't consider an Apple. Someone came in and wanted an Apple II. And I said, I don't know about a computer named after a fruit. So I was a real PC snob. All right. I converted and I am now an absolute Apple fanatic. And so I'm going to have a new MacBook Pro.
All right.
Just have to.
All right. I live in the Windows world and then I use Ubuntu, which is a Linux variety on another laptop. George Peck is our technology contributor and joins us regularly to talk about the old times, it seems like every now
I guess
and then.
So.
This is Tech with Peck. We explore the ideas and innovations that are shaping our digital world today. And this year, of course, marks 50 years since the founding of Apple Computer. Wow. It's a reminder that the personal computer revolution is still relatively a recent chapter in technology history and one that continues to evolve.
So I want to just mention one interesting kind of transition that I remember. So when I went to work for this computer land, it was the introduction of the personal computer and particularly the IBM, which was the first entry into business really of the personal computer. And the idea was mainframes were centralized systems with what were called dumb terminals. Yep. The terminal connected to the central computer and everything was done on the central computer. and there was really no independent computing until the personal computer came along. The personal computer revolution took that away from the central computer, the central processor, and brought it to everybody for an individual computing environment. They ran their own applications, they ran their own computer, they ran their own hard disk, they ran their own memory. They began to network them together, but the power of the personal computer was the revolution. Craig, now we are on web servers and web browsers, and we're right back where we started with a central processing unit. I don't think a web browser can be qualified as a dumb terminal, but it's just a terminal connected to a central server. How things have gone full circle.
You know, I tell people that you probably only need a Chromebook, a $200 Chromebook,
right,
and you can do everything. No, I've got to have this and that. And it's just like, what applications do you use that aren't on the internet these days? And then the answer is pretty much none.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm on my work computer tonight. I have one full client app running only because I want to. There's a web version of it. Everything else is in a browser. You and I are talking in an app on a browser. I have another browser window with about 10 tabs with a slide app and a file app and a calendar app and an email app. I've got my CRM app in another web browser. It is all browser-based. Very few full client apps running on this machine.
George, thanks for the conversation.
Absolutely.
The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota, North Dakota, with funding granted through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services Aging Services Section, is offering the Dementia Care Services Program. With classes offered at many locations in Minnesota and North Dakota, this month learn healthy living, building foundations of caregiving, and how to utilize the 24/7 helpline available in more than 200 languages. Learn more about the Dementia Care Services Program at alz.org/MNND.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
It's Thursday. It's our time to review the news of North Dakota and the region with our news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Glad to be here.
Dave, you were at the Dem NPL convention over last weekend. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, Dave? How did it go? And what are the Dem NPL folks kind of thinking?
There was more, shall we say, energy in the room than I've seen for a while. And I attribute it to the fact that they've done a better job now of finding candidates for legislative races and statewide races. They had competitive for at least one statewide race, and they are trying to fill legislative races too, because there were, a couple of years ago, there were districts that had no Democratic candidates.
Any reason that you can discern for the enthusiasm?
Well, I'm honestly thinking that there's been some publicity about some schism in the Republican Party. So they're saying, wait a second, maybe we have an opportunity here. So they're trying to do it, and they're trying to rebuild the party from where it was, you know, back in the 80s, when you actually had some Democrats who are elected to statewide office, to legislative races, and also, you know, they had a little bit more presence there. But that kind of died, and now it's coming back.
The Republicans, of course, are now planning their statewide convention. Interesting, though, no Republican statewide office holders in competitive races are even going to attend.
That's right.
What does that mean?
They have sensed the schisms, too, because 2 years ago when the Republicans met in Fargo, there was that whole hoorah about getting rid of the Dickinson delegation, District 37. There was some shenanigans about voting for certain people, and Julie Fedorchuk, as a matter of fact, said we're going nowhere here. So she said, "I'm not going for the convention endorsement." She went and got petitions to get on the primary, and she won. So it was kind of a signal to other elected Republicans saying, "Maybe the convention's not the way to be." So it should be very interesting.
Dave, we learned North Dakota is a happy place.
Yes, it is. I will have a story next week on this, and I will just tell you that WalletHub, you know, one of those think tanks, has a survey, and they have surveyed cities in around the country, and North Dakota landed two happy place cities in the top 10. Bismarck was number two. Fargo was number five.
So you're happier than we are over here, Dave? Is that what you're telling us?
We are happier in central North Dakota.
Of course, the internet knows everything, so heck.
It sure does.
We'll look forward to that fun story. Dave, I want to ask you about economic trends that were highlighted in a report now that you've had on the Prairie Public website. 2025 taxable sales numbers are out, and they're telling us maybe some things.
Right, and as the year went on, 2025, you saw an economic slowdown start. And yeah, you could see that. The taxable sales were up by just about 2.7%. And Fargo was the only one to post a decrease in sales, and they were down about 1.6%. It was kind of a foreshadowing of the economic winds that we have throughout North Dakota and throughout the nation right now.
Dave, I've read where North Dakota, a task force, eyes at dissolving dozens of state boards. What does that really mean?
Well, there's a lot of boards and commissions in state government. This is not the first time.
170, Dave.
Yeah, this is not the first time this has been tried. But other committees that have tried to look at slimming it down, they kind of gave up, saying we don't think we can do this. But there's a real effort to try to get some, you know, control over the number of boards and commissions. Whether or not it's going to be successful will be interesting to see when they have put that report to legislative management by the 1st of October.
Dave, Fargo will be looking for a new police chief.
Yes, Zabolski's been there for a while. He's been there about five and a half years. His tenure as chief had its ups and downs and some criticisms, but some kudos as well. And now he's just basically saying, hey, I think it's time. He's got a big anniversary with his wife coming up, and they want to take a vacation while he's retired. Because remember, there was something that happened in Fargo. They couldn't reach him because he had taken a vacation day. And that some of the city leaders and city commissions were kind of criticizing him for that.
And Dave, you're reporting that he'll be stepping down on March 27th, so that'll be something that we'll watch. Dave Thompson and I review the news on Thursdays here on Main Street. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you much, Craig.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, up next, it's All Things Considered here on Prairie Public. Each weekday afternoon, NPR brings you the day's biggest news, thoughtful reporting, and in-depth conversations about the issues shaping our world. Tonight, the ripple effects of foreign aid cuts made by the Trump administration. Then coming up at 8 p.m. Central, it's The Middle. Failure, personally or professionally, is something everyone deals with to some degree, but the late Steve Jobs says it's how you respond to failure that defines you. So, how have you come back from failure? That's tonight on The Middle at 8 p.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and spring is a busy season for hands-on discovery at North Dakota's Gateway to Science. It's in Bismarck. From mini camps and bug-themed learning days to adult STEM nights and robotics challenges, there's something happening for learners of every age. And joining us now is Alicia Kellum. She's the education director at North Dakota's Gateway to Science. Such a beautiful place, and she'll walk us through the upcoming events and how families, educators, and curious minds can get involved. Alicia, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. We have so many amazing things going on in March and April. We're really filling up our calendar. So in March, to begin with, on March 14th, we have our preschool discovery hour, and our theme this month is bugging out, so it should be a really fun one. On March 16th, on-site, we're hosting mini camps for days off of school. On March 21st, we have our next Gateway After Dark, which will be an adult STEM camp. So it's like STEM camp, but for adults. Very excited for that one. On March 23rd, we start our second session of STEM Adventure Club. We have kids that are in Adventure Club right now, and so the second 6-week session will start on March 23rd. And just to wrap it up, the first week in April is going to be Robotics Week. So definitely stay tuned for some amazing things that are going to happen that week. And the end of April is Nature Week. And we've got on-site and off-site events with that. So lots of really great things going on.
So if people want to participate in any one of these great activities or opportunities, what should they do?
Great question. I would head out to our website at gatewaytoscience.org, and all the information that you need will be right there.
And remind us, Alicia, when is the Gateway to Science open, the North Dakota Gateway to Science, and where can people find you?
We are at 1600 Canary Avenue, which is on the BSC campus. So come and visit us. Our hours of operation are Sunday, we're open from 1 to 5. Monday, we're open from 10 a.m. to 5. Tuesdays right now, we are closed for maintenance, but there might be some updates with that coming up in the next few months. Wednesday, we're open early from 9 to 5. Thursday, we're open late from 10 to 7. And then Friday and Saturday, we're open from 10 to 5.
And for our listeners who may not know, BSC stands for Bismarck State College. Alicia, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 12th. Heraldry dates back to the Middle Ages. Knights in armor wore helmets that covered their faces, making it impossible to identify who they were, or, in battle, which side they were on. Although heraldry is most often associated with medieval Europe, it made its way to the New World. In 1919, President Woodrow Wilson directed the creation of the Heraldic Program Office. Overseen by the War Department, the office was tasked with coordinating and approving coats of arms and other insignia for the Army. By the end of World War II, its role had expanded to include other branches of the military. Today, the Institute of Heraldry provides guidance in the design of flag agency seals, badges, and other official emblems. On this date in 1937, the Institute of Heraldry approved the design for the North Dakota Distinguished Service Medal. The medal recognizes current or former members of the North Dakota National Guard who, in the discharge of their military duties, exhibited extraordinary heroism or devotion to duty. The governor is authorized to present the medal in the name of the legislature and the people of the state. Approval of the award is determined by a board made up of the Adjutant General and senior officers. No award may be presented to anyone whose service after the recommendation has not been honorable. A recipient may receive only one medal. If later deemed worthy of a second honor, the individual receives a small badge attached to the original ribbon. Several other medals recognize the service of the state's National Guard members. The Basic Training Medal is awarded to those who complete training. The North Dakota National Guard Emergency Service Ribbon honors service members who directly support the state, including those who respond to emergencies and natural disasters. The Outstanding Unit Ribbon recognizes Guard members who contribute to the unit's overall exceptional achievements. Members of the National Guard provide valuable service both in combat and in response to emergencies at home. Ribbons and medals are one way to recognize their service to the state and to the nation. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Israeli strikes in Lebanon have now displaced hundreds of thousands of people. Many are sleeping in shelters or on the streets and wonder when, if ever, they can return to their homes. We'll hear their stories and also reporting from Leila Fadel in Iraq on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Thursday's episode of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org, or better yet, subscribe to us as a podcast. Monday, we'll be back with part two of our interview with Watford City's mayor. Until then, thank you so much for joining us and have a great North Dakota weekend.